This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hammerich. Today's episode is another great example of a farmer experimenting with new ideas and figuring out what works best for him on his farm when it comes to soil health. Blaine Coomer farms with his wife and parents south of Fargo in Colfax, North Dakota. They raise corn, soybeans, sugar beets, wheat, and occasionally some barley. The soil in his area is really variable, from silty sand to Fargo silt clays. He came back to the farm after graduating from NDSU, and over the years has tried a variety of techniques to figure out how to build healthier soils. Blaine said, as an industry, there's still obviously a lot of room for improvement when it comes to soil health, and that was sure evident in the spring of 2021.
Springs like this spring are a prime example that usually by this time of the winter, everybody's forgotten it, and all, you know, there's not a lot of stuff blowing around, but we had severe crop damage, I would say, this year due to blowing soil. And there was a few days in June this year where we're talking 30, 40 plus mile an hour winds. There was a week in there where you could see it 30 miles away, the whole horizon just covered in dirt blowing, hung up in the air. And it was like this train coming through, you know, you could see dirt coming for 30 miles and just beating the crop. And corn plants that were probably 3 or 4 leaf corn plants getting sod right down to the ground. There's not much you can do. And so, you know, you just try to figure out what can we possibly do in the future. Another thing that we do, and you usually get pretty good results, is spreading cover crop out in the spring. So say you did not get a good rye establishment the previous fall. We've had decent luck spreading barley in the spring or oats and planting soybeans or corn. And then both crops are coming up together. And then when you go out and do your herbicide program, at some point you try to terminate this cover crop so it doesn't become a weed. And when you get those extreme weather events where you've got soil blowing, things like that are a big deal.
Well, blowing soil is certainly one major concern with the wind. Another concern is that it can blow sugar beet seedling plants right out of the ground. This is one area that Blaine and his father have found that cover crops help in planting rice strips.
We've tried a lot of different things. We do some planting into cover crops, you know, winter rye established the previous year. We really like seeding soybeans under that situation. Sugar beets. That's a practice my dad used to use back in the 90s, where we would go out in September and seed rye in strips after a wheat crop. And then the next spring, we just go and plant in between the rye strips and plant sugar beets. And then the rye protects the beets from getting blown out. When the sugar beets are fairly young, the winds will helicopter them right out of the ground. Each crop's a little bit different, I think. Sugar beets are a little more sensitive to the rye in the field versus soybeans. I think soybeans seem like it's maybe less of an issue as far as a yield drag due to that.
And if there's one overarching theme for today's episode, it's experimentation. Blaine emphasized throughout our conversation that he still feels like he's figuring things out and always trying something new to see what works best for him. And that's definitely been true when it comes to cover crops.
Yeah, we've tried several things. I think the first time, besides doing the seeding rye strips and strips like we did in the 90s, I think maybe after like 2009 was a pretty bad spring where we had some prevent plant. And that was right around the time when rye and rapeseed and turnips and radishes, for me, was maybe the first time I had experience trying that. And so tried that on a field. And the next spring, when we went to plant soybeans there, it was conditions were beautiful. The ground was nice and mellow. The moisture for a seedbed was perfect. And and it's your first time and you're out in this field, you've got waist tall canola and rye growing, and you think there's no way we're going to be able to plant this. This is a mess. And I think that year we probably maybe ran a Selford or a Super Colt or, you know, a vertical tillage piece of equipment across it to try to manage that. In hindsight, I don't know if we needed to or not. We've had pretty good luck in recent years just leaving the rye standing and just drive a planter and air seeder right through it. I think for us, that's worked better. In that scenario, it worked fine to try to size the material. And you think, you know, we thought to ourselves we were controlling that cover crop. But with rye especially, it seems like you can use the rye to your advantage and have something growing and plant into it. And then you spray the rye out. And at that point, you've got a nice mat. And the rye seems to help control weeds early as well. It's already choked out a flush of weeds. Not that you get by without a herbicide program, but it definitely seems to help choke out weeds as well.
One of the biggest challenges to cover crops, especially in a place like North Dakota, is of course timing. The logistics are tough enough to grow just one crop, and squeezing in a second one before winter comes can sure be tricky.
That is also a difficult thing when you have a corn and soybean rotation. In wet years, if a person has any prevented plant acres, we've messed around with winter wheat and winter rye. We've messed around with barley. We've had barley that we've put on, say, a field that was too wet to get established. That spring, we planted barley as a cover crop, and then we've no-tilled into that the next spring, just like the winter rye. We've done that with winter wheat. A lot of the cover cropping we do, you know, in an early season, say, after a wheat crop or a barley crop, you can drill it back in. We utilize an airplane quite a bit. There's a local pilot that does a really good job, and his response time is fast. He does a good job, and so he'll have product, or if you have your own, whatever. But so we'll use him to fly into an established crop. Then it just depends on the weather. Sugar beets is a tough one because a sugar beet crop, once you've harvested it, you have basically a black field. And so normal farmers cannot stand to watch fields blow. It just drives you insane. Sugar beet harvest is quite drawn out. You know, pre-lip starts opening the headlands, taking off parts of the field sometime usually in August, September. We'll have those guys fly on barley or rye as we're taking parts of these fields off, and then we'll incorporate it, or we'll have them fly it in front of us, and then we'll go out and lift the beets. We've tried that where the act of harvest is covering the cover crop up, and we've had good luck both ways. But you also, at that point, the later you get, you're at the mercy of the fall. And if you have a warm fall, or say something can continue to get established well into October, you have a lot better results versus if you have a cold, wet, crummy fall, maybe you're not going to have as good of luck. So it's one of those where I don't have the answer to what the best way to do that is yet. I think in 2019, we had really good luck. We see a lot of barley on sugar beet fields as we were harvesting them, and we just kept getting good catches, which led to having a really nicely established cover crop that helped with stopping soil erosion from the time that you've lifted those beets up until the next spring where you plant your next crop. And somewhere, Abby probably has them. I'm sure I would have sent her pictures of no-tilling corn into barley from a previous year sugar beet crop and having very minimal blowing. So we were pretty excited about that. Then you fast forward to maybe the next year. Maybe this year may be an example of, I don't think we had quite as good luck. Maybe our timing was a little bit off. Maybe, you know, a freeze got it or something. And so, unfortunately, you just keep throwing things at the wall that you think are going to potentially work. And then sometimes it works all great. And sometimes you see nothing happen and you try again next time.
Certainly, flying on cover crops makes a lot of sense from a logistics standpoint. But I wondered about the costs of doing this. Blaine, walk me through the economics of this decision.
Well, I think this would probably depend on where you farm and what your local aerial applicators are set up to do. You know, not everybody's set up to do a dry product. When you think of crop dusters, you think of a guy spraying herbicides or fungicides, insecticides, whatever, you know, by air in the growing season. Our aerial applicator, we utilize them for both fertilizer and cover crops. So we'll spread urea by air into a standing corn crop, into a standing wheat crop, and also spreading cover crops. So it kind of comes down for us, what they've structured for the cost to us to do it, I think is reasonable, especially considering the time. Say we're trying to get some cover crop down on sugar beets. You know, you're already harvesting and it takes quite a few people because you need a lot of truck drivers. You need a lot of people to operate equipment. So you're already feeling kind of maxed out on personnel, and you give those guys a call and you get it lined up. And so the amount of acres that they can hammer out in an hour is it's really impressive and do a nice job. And, you know, they spend the time to make sure they have all their equipment set up. And so they have a nice spreading pattern and, you know, they know what they're doing. So you call them up and get it lined up. And the timing aspect is huge.
Well, as we talk about often on this show, everybody's situation is going to be a little bit different. And it's all about adjusting your system to optimize for production efficiency and, of course, soil health. Changing his system led Blaine to try something pretty unconventional that he says has worked out really well for him. Not only flying on cover crops, but fertilizer as well.
So in 2007, I think, we went from 30-inch rows to 20-inch rows. So we went to narrow rows because at that time we were seeding corn and sugar beets in 30-inch rows, and we were seeding soybeans in 15-inch rows using an air seeder. So then in the mid-2000s, we switched to 20-inch rows with the idea that we were going to go 20-inch corn, 20-inch soybeans. And at that time, we stayed 30-inch beets because we had all the beet equipment and everything set up that way. And the 20-inch rows and the 30-inch rows, the tractors, we used track tractors, and they all lined up. So a track tractor could go to this field or this field. It didn't matter. You could drive down the rows. And so that was part of our decision-making process, going to 20-inch rows. So now we're planting corn and soybeans in 20-inch rows. And we, instead of side dressing anymore, we went to primarily a spring fertilizer program. And I think it was 2011 or 2013. It was 2011. It was so wet in spring. We got our crop planted, and then it was wet, and it rained more and rained more. So pretty soon you're losing nitrogen. It's either leaching or denitrifying into the air. It was horrible. And it was too wet. It didn't matter the row width. Guys that were trying to side dress, whatever you were trying to normally do to get your fertilizer onto your crop was very challenging. And the weather wasn't giving you much of a window or opportunity to do it. And so that was the year we started talking to our local pilot about this. For us, anyhow, that was the way we thought we could get nitrogen to our corn crop. So we sat down with those guys after that and said, okay, what do you think? Like, is this something we can realistically do? Because it's not a common practice. So we talked about what the logistics are of using a dry product through the airplane. You know, we live 30 miles from Wahpeton and Fargo, so we're not very close to an airport. How are you going to logistically do this so it works for us and it works for them and it's not too timely, not too costly, going back to the who can do it cheaper and how much time? And so then we spent some time the next year laying out different fields. And so we laid out a field at this part of our farm. We laid out several fields, and we just decided that winter, okay, let's just commit right now to doing the fertilizer program with the airplane as part of it, and then using that split app. So those fields, we put X amount of fertilizer down in the spring, and then we waited until July. And the nice thing about using the plane was that our window opened up quite a bit. So you could try to time it to a rain because you're spreading dry fertilizer on top of the ground. So the good thing is he's probably got 5-6 foot tall corn. So you've got a little bit of a microclimate there. We treat the urea with inhibitors so it doesn't volatilize as easily. So we got a little bit of wider window there. So we could try to time his application to a potential rain in the forecast. You know, we've had more good luck than bad luck doing that. And so that's kind of how we got down that road and sat down that winter and laid a plan out and stuck to it, not knowing if it was not that it's a genius plan. Like, there's many different ways to get fertilizer to a crop, but we on this farm thought this has got to be a way that could work. You just can't be doing it in a year where all the other ways that you've done it are not working. And so you're backpedaling, trying to figure out what can you do. So since then, we've tried this method for, well, since then, I guess, since like 2012, and had overall very good results.
Blaine said this approach of really dialing in the timing of his fertilizer program is especially helpful in a year like this one, when fertilizer prices are so high.
Well, one thing it's done is it helped give us control of our fertilizer again. You know, guys will side dress, you know, anhydrous, guys will side dress or top dress urea, guys will side dress at 28%. There's nothing wrong with any of those methods. And what it gives you is that timing. And so with a corn crop, it's always okay. Try to have your timing down of when the corn needs nutrients to versus are you just putting nutrients out when it's convenient for yourself or when you have the manpower or when you're doing it, you know. And some years it may not matter at all, but in some years, if early season, it's so wet that you're going to lose nitrogen that you've applied, so it's not going to be available to your crop. Not only are you talking about lost potential of your overall corn crop and yield, you're talking about the money you already spent on fertilizer applied to the field, and then you lose it. And so it's a double whammy right there. So that's what this did. We worked out so how we could do it logistically so it works out for him. And the really cool thing about it is once we got this program going and once the pilot was comfortable with it and we have areas laid out of how we're going to do this and so we can maximize his time, because that was one of their concerns. You know, how are we going to do this? This guy's in an airplane and they got a couple of pilots out there, but so each guy's in an airplane, they need to cover ground in a day. Their job is to cover so many acres and that's fair. So once we got this figured out where we could, you're not going to waste his time, he can cover a lot of ground. So we just take so many units of nitrogen, you know, for the corn crop, and then we allot it to that time frame of, for us, which is, you know, approximately mid to late July.
Well, you've heard about Blaine's experiments with cover crops and his approach to flying on fertilizer he just talked about. But he also says one of the biggest pitfalls he tries to avoid when it comes to building healthier soils is just being in too much of a hurry.
You try to set up a plan the best you can, previous fall, let's say, and then as the spring's unfolding, you just kind of play with the cards you're dealt. And we try to approach the spring with a less is more mentality. So, you know, you don't have the guys just driving tractors back and forth trying to do things just to do it. You try to have a little more structured approach to it, which is extremely challenging sometimes because, it's usually in your nature to go, go, go. And if you're not doing something, it's a very easy, I don't know if you call it farmer mentality or just human nature, but to not do something is difficult. And so that's a big hurdle to get over of just sitting back and being a little more patient versus forging ahead and sometimes making the situation worse than it was the day before. You know, one of the guys that helps us every year in the spring is a retired farmer, and he's probably, I'm going to guess, 70 years old this year. Maybe he's 71 this year. Anyway, he comes every spring and helps with tillage. And he, when he farmed more towards the heavier clay grounds than maybe we did at that time, and definitely more than I did growing up. And so his insight's usually pretty good because, you know, he's got this knowledge. So he can be in a tractor 10 miles away from you and say, I'm driving a planter or another tractor doing something else, whatever I'm doing. He can communicate it over the radio. Well, this is kind of what it looks like. And, you know, he knows what's going to happen if he goes into a field and it's too wet. And say he's doing something as minimal as a drag. You know, he can tell you over the radio, oh, I think it's a little too wet, we should wait a day, or I think it's just right, or I don't think this is going to work. And if the planter can be the only thing in the field, he knows I like that. And so he'll just call me up and say, you know, I think you should just come here and try it. I think you'd be better off if I leave, which that kind of knowledge and communication is a big deal, because if the person driving that tractor doesn't think that way, they can spend 3 or 4 hours just driving back and forth on the field and say you're tied up fixing something else or getting a planter set or doing something else, after 4 hours, the damage is done and there's no coming back from it. So that's been part of our journey, is getting everybody to have kind of that mentality of it's okay not to do a whole bunch of tillage every spring and just see what we can do. Because especially when you're in limited moisture, you go back to a spring like last year and there was extremely limited moisture. And so even doing a tillage pass or maybe a tillage pass too far in front of a planter by hours, you could lose the moisture you needed for a good seed bed. Once that's happened, it's either back praying for a rain or the ship has sailed, so there's no going back. So,
and another part of being patient, Blaine says, is just to keep trying new things. Taking a systems-based approach to improve soil health is going to take a lot of trial and error.
The biggest thing I could say with cover crops, it's like everything else, is that you just keep learning things you don't know. And you try something and you learn from it. And the next time you try it, you may or may not get the same results. You might get different results. And sometimes you get no results and it can be frustrating. And that's probably the toughest, especially, you know, if you sit down and you go, okay, well, I spent this many dollars per acre trying this and it just didn't work. But then if you've done it for a few years, you look back, well, I tried this almost exact experiment over here and it worked and we had great results, but it was a different set of circumstances or the weather was different, or, you know, as much as you want to just group things that you do into this works and this doesn't work, there's always so many variables that go into each thing. Do it at a scale where if the results are poor or frustrating, you don't feel like you need to throw your hands up and quit. Because you get an example like this spring where we had the field of beans that were not only just soybeans, but they were for seed production on a variety with limited seed. And it was pure dumb luck that I had them planted into growing winter rye. And that when the freeze event hit, the only damage we saw was on the field edges next to the ditch, or like maybe in the ditches running through the field. Other than that, it ended up being a fantastic field of soybeans, to where if they would have been frozen off and been just a 95% kill like the fields by the farm, you were done for the year. You can replant soybeans, but you cannot replant the variety where the seed does not exist. So that's probably the thing I've learned, is that you just keep trying things and sometimes the different results are good and sometimes you look back and you wish you had better results, but there's all you can do is keep trying. And then there, odds are there's somebody maybe in your area. You know, there's some guys in our area that are pretty good resources that have tried a lot with cover crops and can kind of help coach you along the way. I'd say Abby knows all of them, if not most of them.
Well, thank you very much to Blaine Coomer for sharing his soil health journey with us here on another great podcast episode. You can follow up with him on Twitter. He's at TheK2BK. So it's THEK, the number 2BK. We'll put it in the show notes as well. Also want to thank our sponsors of Soil Sense: the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from this podcast, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and share your favorite episodes on Twitter using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with another great episode next week.